Next case is State of Ohio versus Stephen Johnson. Mr. Van.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chief Justice Brown, Justice of the Supreme Court. My name is Daniel Van. I'm an assistant prosecutor. I represent the state of Ohio and appearing on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. And if I may, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case is about Ohio's weapons under disability statute. Under Ohio law, a person may not knowingly acquire, use, or have a firearm or dangerous ordnance if they have one of five disabling conditions. Those five disabling conditions are an indictment for a drug abuse offense or a violent felony, which this court discussed in Clay, a conviction for a drug abuse offense or violent felony, which is what is at issue today. The three remaining disabilities are being adjudicated, mentally incompetent, being a drug dependent person, and being a fugitive from justice. In this case, Stephen Johnson was indicted for having weapons under a disability. The state alleged that Mr. Johnson had two disabling convictions, possession of marijuana and possession of a counterfeit substance. At trial, Stephen Johnson stipulated to both convictions, raised a self-defense claim, and admitted to the possession of the firearm. On appeal,
the facts are a little scrambled here, but for purposes of our review, he acknowledges that he used it or he had possession of it, whether it was his or whether it belonged to this other woman, and he wrestled it away from. For our purposes, we don't have to worry about that. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe the facts are relevant in that on appeal, this 8th District found structural error in this case.
In the indictment?
The 8th District did found that this there was a required state of recklessness, and that we were supposed to prove that Stephen Johnson was reckless in his awareness that he had been convicted of an offense that disabled him from carrying a firearm. In addition, the 8th District found that the error in that indictment permeated the entire trial, resulting in structural error, which required reversal in this case.
If I can summarize what I think the difference between Clay and this case is, in Clay, it was lack of knowledge of a factual issue that he had been indicted and he didn't know it. Here, isn't it the allegation that it's a lack of the knowledge of the law, and the Court of Appeals put a reckless standard on it when we generally have case law that says ignorance of the law is no excuse. So is that the difference between Clay and this case? One's ignorance of the law and one is ignorance of a fact?
That's correct. The state maintains in this case that strict liability applies with regards to the conviction. But if reckless were to apply, what extent does that apply? The 8th District suggests, and what is being argued by defense in this case, is that Stephen Johnson, we had to prove that Stephen Johnson was reckless in his awareness that his offense constituted an offense which is involved the use of a drug of abuse. And the state argues that that is a mistake of law defense. Whether or not an offense constitutes that category of drug of abuse is a matter of law. And the way we indict these cases, in the indictment, it shows what the prior convictions were.
Mr. Van, I guess I want to make sure I understand your concern. Is the concern that in reading the Court of Appeals opinion that you believe the court is directing that not only the defendant, that there be a mens rea requirement not only as to knowing of the prior conviction, but that you believe the Court of Appeals went farther and requires a mens rea requirement that the defendant know the legal implications of that prior conviction? Is that your reading of the Court of Appeals case?
That's correct. I mean, this state's our reading of the case is that the Eighth District required us to show that Stephen Johnson was reckless in his awareness that his conviction was of such that it disabled him from possessing a firearm.
So your concern then, if I understand, is not just that there be a mens rea requirement as to knowing about a previous conviction or being reckless about a previous conviction, but that with respect to the legal implications of that prior conviction.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in this case, the state does maintain that we are not required to prove the culpable mental state of recklessness with regards to a prior conviction. In Clay, this court discussed the unique situation of a defendant who was under indictment for a drug abuse offense. In that case, it was apparent that the concerns were that a person does not necessarily know of the indictment. It could be a secret indictment, and he has no awareness that he has an indictment and that disability has attached. But the state contends that Clay is not dispositive of this case. The fact that this court has interpreted a mental state recklessly to the condition of being under indictment does not require the placement of recklessness when we are dealing with a conviction.
So, counsel, you're basically saying that you want a declaration by this court that it's there is no mens rea requirement. If you've been convicted of X, Y, and Z, you cannot carry a firearm, and you're presumed to know that, and there is no self-defense defense to that preclusion.
Your Honor's question correctly, yes, the state is asking that we not need to prove a culpable mental state with regards to the defendant's knowledge of the conviction. With regards to a self-defense claim, as was raised by Stephen Johnson in this case, Stephen Johnson contended that that wasn't his firearm. He did not bring it into the house. The facts of this case is that a fight broke out, and his claim was that he grabbed this gun. It wasn't his. He only grabbed it to defend himself. And so...
And you're saying that wouldn't matter? He's precluded from having a firearm.
No, Your Honor. Stephen Johnson would still be able to raise that self-defense claim. I only picked this up because I needed to defend myself. And that becomes a matter for the fact finder, whether it's a bench trial or a jury, to decide whether he knowingly brought that into the house, or whether he had to pick this up out of self-defense.
Mr. Van, looking at it a different way, if I understand it correctly, looking at the statute, we start with the knowing possession. That's the element of knowing is in the possession part of it, and then the five elements that follow seem to say nothing. They don't mention a mental state at all. Since there's silence on the mental state with respect to those elements, if we look at the other statute, there must be an intent shown for strict liability. And if there's no intent for strict liability, then the default mens rea is reckless. Would you agree with that so far?
Yes, I would, Your Honor.
Okay, and we have had some cases that say if you're talking about the same subsection, which you're talking about 2923.13a, you start out with knowingly, which is the specific mens rea or mental state, and then you have the others that have nothing. We have had cases, I believe the Lozier case, which said that is the intent for strict liability. So is that the position that the state is taking?
That's the position the state would take, that, and this was raised in Clay, that we have a statute that is structurally similar to the statute at issue in Maxwell, which was dealt with pandering obscenity, bringing those objects into the state. But in reading this court's opinion in Clay, this court found while the statute is structurally similar to the one that was at issue in Maxwell, this court found that there were no plain indications outside the statute that the General Assembly intended to pose strict liability with regards to the condition of being under indictment.
Right. It's the idea of if there's a missing, if the element does not have a mental state, we don't automatically say that means strict liability. Something more must be shown in the statute to say we intended no mental state for this particular element.
Yes, we would agree with that.
Okay.
Statement.
I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
And going back to our argument that Clay is not controlling, what we have in this statute is a subdivision with indictment and or conviction. State would interpret that as two separate and distinct discrete clauses, which two separate mental states could apply. And this court has taken such an approach in its prior holding, for example, in Lozier, with regards to, you know, possession of the drugs within the vicinity of a juvenile and vicinity of a school. Granted, the state would concede that, again, vicinity of the juvenile definition had an explicit mens rea of knowingly built in. So that doesn't necessarily control here, but what the state argues and has explained throughout our briefs that there are outside indications outside of statute that the General Assembly intended to impose strict liability. There's a very strong stance when the General Assembly enacted the statute to keep the firearms out of the hands of people who are believed to be a bad risk. In Ohio, for example, if Mr. Johnson was a responsible gun owner and wanted to carry a concealed weapon, he would have to fill out his application and answer on that form whether he had been convicted of an offense, you know, involving drugs. Also, if Mr. Johnson had committed this offense, I believe this was years ago, he had an option of seeking relief from this disability. And the revised code provides for such a mechanism. But under that section, the relief from disability, Mr. Johnson's disability would be automatically reinstated upon commission of one of those offenses, be it a violent felony or a drug offense. And so the state did go through more examples throughout the brief. And going outside the statute is something this court has done before. This court did so in Maxwell, and looking at the strong stance that the General Assembly had against crimes, sex crimes involving minors. What we have here in this case is a very strong stance of the dangers that certain individuals have with firearms in their possession. It's clear from reading chapter 29, 23, and the various statutes that these individuals pose a clear and present danger. They pose a risk. And if Stephen Johnson was a responsible gun owner and gone through the proper mechanisms to either possess or obtain these firearms, he would know of that disability.
Mr. Vann, this is the type of offense that could just follow the statute directly, and even under Colon, there would be no problem. Is that correct? Because you have the first part saying knowingly possessing, and then if you pick up any one of the five, just as it's written in the statute, without a mental state, because we're talking basically status, the person's a fugitive from justice or under indictment or various things that don't require a mental state, you would automatically say that you don't need to add recklessness to the indictment. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct with regards to the conviction in this case.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, Your Honor, I would like to reserve my remaining time.
You may. Mr. Martin?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. John Martin on behalf of Stephen Johnson. Your Honors, we urge this court to affirm the holding of the 8th District, which held that in order to be convicted of this crime of having a weapon under disability, the state must prove that the defendant was recklessly aware that he had been convicted of an offense that prohibited him from having a weapon.
How does that principle comply with, you know where I'm going, ignorance of the law is no excuse? Because that basically says you can be ignorant of the law, plead it as an excuse, and you're not reckless.
Respectfully, Your Honor, there is a distinction. The axiom that ignorance of the law is no excuse, time-worn, and we don't challenge it, says that my client is conclusively presumed to know that it was against the law to knowingly possess a firearm while if he had committed an offense involving possession of a drug of abuse. I'm leaving out the trafficking and the rest of those for this purpose, possession of a drug of abuse. So that underlying law, he's presumed to know. He has to know. There's no ignorance. He cannot come into court and say, I didn't know that I wasn't allowed to possess a firearm after having been convicted of an offense involving possession of a drug of abuse. That's the underlying law. But ignorance of the law is no excuse, does not come into play when it comes to the issue of, did my client know, A, that he had been convicted of an offense, and B, and this goes, I believe, to Mr. Chief Justice, to your question to the prosecutor, and B, did that offense involve possession of, was that offense an offense involving a possession of a drug of abuse? What does the word, so if my client says, for example, or if the jury has, because my client has no burden here, if the jury has a reasonable doubt as to whether or not my client did not understand that a misdemeanor is an offense, if he did not understand that marijuana is considered by law a drug of abuse, as opposed to perhaps other types of drugs, then this is not ignorance of the law. The U.S. Supreme Court,
You want us to establish a rule that says that you have to prove that this person knew he was convicted and that there was a drug involved, that he had to know he was convicted of a drug involved? I mean, he's in court, he has a judge say you're guilty. I mean, what more evidence do you need to establish it? I mean, you could take judicial notice of it. I mean, how do you prove that he was reckless?
Your Honor, you prove that he was reckless the same way you prove any other element that requires scienter, any other element that requires criminal intent, and you
So the defendant can come in and say, well, I didn't really know that I was convicted because this was a misdemeanor, and the judge said you're guilty, but I didn't know that meant a conviction?
I did not know that that was an offense, or I did not know that marijuana was a drug of abuse, and the state, if my client were the one who came in and testified to that effect, then the crucible of cross-examination will put that to the test. And if 12 of his peers find beyond a reasonable doubt that that's not credible, then he'll lose. But if they don't, then he will not. And, Your Honors, this is exactly what the United States Supreme Court dealt with in two landmark decisions, United States versus Morissette, United States versus Liberata. Morissette was a case where Mr. Morissette had possession of government property. It was unauthorized by law that he had this property. He thought the property had been abandoned and that because it was abandoned, he had not converted government property. It turns out government property cannot be abandoned.
But that's a pretty far cry from saying, I didn't know marijuana was a drug of abuse. I mean, there you've got sort of a technical issue as to whether it's abandoned or not. Here, a sixth grader knows that.
Well,
excuse me.
Your Honor, I would submit to the court that it could be said in Liberata that a sixth grader knows that if he buys food stamps at less than face value, that something's hinky there. And despite that fact, in Liberata versus United States, the court said you still have to prove scienter. The fact that it may be very fundamental that a person would know these things will go to the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence. It will go to the issue of whether or not my client will be successful. But the issue of whether he has that opportunity or whether the structure of this trial was such that he never had that opportunity is what is before the court today.
Well, counsel, you don't have to have scienter. You don't have to prove scienter in a strict liability offense, do you?
No, Your Honor, you do not.
And as I understand it, the Eighth District looked at the Clay case and said because there was recklessness for whether you know you're under indictment, because it was an unusual case, the indictment hadn't been served. So the person didn't know that he was indictment, but this court held that, well, he should have known, so he was reckless in that regard, and so it was the charge was effective. They're extrapolating that and saying, well, now you have to apply this knowledge about your conviction, and not only just your conviction, but also the consequences of that conviction. That's quite an extrapolation from a situation where a person didn't know, hadn't been served with the indictment, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, several points there. Number one, the General Assembly ultimately decides whether things are going to be strict liability or not. And they placed the conviction of these types of offenses in the same sentence with the indictment. And so the General Assembly, the starting point, of course, in any statutory interpretation, are the words of the statute. And the General Assembly, in this case, placed them in the same sentence, placed them in the same subsection, and therefore chose not to make a distinction. Had the General Assembly wanted to, they could have so said that this will be strict liability. They chose not to. And respectfully, it is not for the state, in response to the state of Ohio's argument, the state of Ohio wants this court to act in a legislative capacity in that regard and to add a strict liability where the General Assembly did not. One reason.
Counsel, if you're advocating for the reckless standard here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And Mr. Johnson knew that he was convicted of a drug offense, correct?
We don't concede that, Your Honor.
Well, all right. He knew he had a conviction.
He stipulated to the fact that there was a conviction. Okay. He did not stipulate to his own scienter with respect to that conviction at the time he possessed the firearm.
Say that again.
At the time he possesses the firearm, he has to be aware of his conviction. When he gets to trial, the only thing he stipulates to is that there was a conviction. Whether that was in his mind at that time or not, and what the consequences of that were things that were never
part
of the situation.
But a conviction is not sufficient enough, based on your argument. He has to have, it would be a conviction, and knowing that by virtue of that conviction, it was the category of conviction that would preclude him from having a firearm.
Yes.
Okay. He knew he got arrested, and he knew he went to court, and he knew that there was that there was a conviction.
He was in, yes, Your Honor, he was in
okay.
court and he knew there was convicted of something.
All right, and he knew that at the time he had the weapon, that in the past, at some point, I was convicted of something. So he says, but the heck with it, I'm still going to pick up this gun. Well, so is that not reckless, knowing that I've got some, and rather than check out and see whether my conviction would preclude me from having a weapon under certain circumstances, I don't care, I'm just going to pick up this gun and let the chips fall where they may.
And Your Honor, and that may very well have been the state's argument, but the jury was never given that opportunity to consider those types of arguments. And in this case, in fact, the prosecutor at pages 361 to 65 just argues knowingly possession of a firearm, and the court's jury instructions, which are found at around 412, does not create a scienter with respect to that.
And you're not arguing that he didn't know he had a firearm, though. He knew he had
a
weapon.
He knew he had a firearm. That's not an issue before the court today. There is a necessity defense,
which
was the subject of issues below that have never been decided. Yes,
Mr. Martin, the only reason we have this case is because of Cologne and the idea that each element must have a specific mens rea attached to the indictment, and there was no mens rea attached to the issue of the person being under indictment or being convicted, et cetera, under A3, correct?
Certainly, Cologne is the landmark decision in this regard, but Cologne, I would say that Cologne followed from a long line of both cases as well as statutory provisions regarding
And the 8th District talked about structural error and so on.
Yes.
But when you look at the statute, I mean, if in the olden days, pre-Cologne, if the prosecutor had just indicted using the language of the statute, the notice to the defendant is knowingly, the knowing possession, that obvious, and then the five subsections there really having no mental state, the argument, I think, was that, you know, this is a status offense. You've got a person who's a fugitive from justice, or a status element, let's say, fugitive from justice. It doesn't matter if you're a fugitive. That in and of itself doesn't require a mental state. And the same thing with three. If there's a conviction, it doesn't require any mental state. So I guess the argument would be, is that strict liability? Is that sufficient to show strict liability? Because if we have silence and there's no showing of strict liability, then you go to the status of reckless.
Right. Reckless becomes the default,
right,
which
default.
Requires, of course, that perverse disregard of a substantial risk. It's
right.
more than just negligence. But, Your Honor, to answer your question, the status, if you will, of being under indictment is also a status. And so this court found, you know, it's that's one of the other statuses that are within that provision of A3. And it therefore, when the General Assembly did not want strict liability as to that status, that's an indication that they don't want strict liability as to any of the others. I would point out, too, as a matter of basic fairness, this is not simply how many angels can dance on the head of the pin. The fact is that the General Assembly has broadly interpreted the disability, broadly defined the disability, to include offenses involving drugs of abuse. That goes so far as the minor misdemeanor traffic ticket for your marijuana joint that you sign and mail in with your check. And I would suggest to the court that due process is violated when you have a situation where that type of uncounseled, pay the check, send it in, and guess what? You're now disabled from ever having a weapon. And I'd point out the amicus brief that was filed in this case, which came straight out and said that nobody knows this in terms of, as a general matter, in municipal court. And I would suggest to the court that if the General Assembly decides, as was their right, to expand disability to that extent, then it also makes sense that with that expansion of disability would be an inclusion of scienter.
Mr. Martin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me go back to the question that I had asked Mr. Van earlier, because I want to be clear. And as listening to you throughout your argument, I'm not sure that you've been clear. And the question is, with respect to scienter.
Yes.
And I certainly agree about ignorance of the laws. We're not going to go there. But what facts is it that your client needs to be aware of in order to be convicted here? The question is it knowledge of a prior conviction? Is it knowledge of a prior conviction of drug abuse? Or does it need to go farther and be not only knowledge of those things, but knowledge of an offense of drug abuse, or of a prior conviction of an offense of drug abuse, that carries a disability?
Your Honor, I see my time has ended. With leave, I would like to answer your question. It is door number two. It requires knowledge of a conviction that is an offense involving the possession of a drug of abuse. That defining term in A3, that elemental term in A3, has a scienter requirement that carries with it. The third option that Your Honor gave me would go to the underlying crime, and it is at that point that ignorance of the law is no excuse cuts in and undercuts any argument in that regard. So it would be he must know that he was convicted. It wasn't a no-contest plea that resulted in a dismissal, for example, as sometimes happens in municipal court.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
It wasn't a thank you.
So are you saying A3 is not reckless but knowingly? Is that what I hear you saying?
I'm sorry, with leave, Your Honor.
Please.
I'm sorry, I misspoke when I used the term knowingly there. I should have said recklessly aware.
Okay.
So I apologize for that.
So all right, let's clarify that. Recklessly knowing of the conviction? No, he had to be reckless with regard to a conviction of a drug offense that produces a disability.
Recklessly aware of a conviction.
Or recklessly, recklessly unaware. I mean, because, go ahead.
Yes. Of an offense that involves the possession of a drug of abuse. And that's as far as it goes. That element of convicted for an offense involving a drug of abuse That element requires the scienter of recklessness.
All right, and then the consequence of whether or not he could have in his possession a firearm has no requirement of knowledge.
That's correct, because that would go to the ignorance of the law is no excuse, because that would go then to the underlying crime.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Vann, 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Vann, do we need to retreat from some of the language in Clay for you to prevail?
No, we do not, Your Honor. This court held that there are no outside indications that the General Assembly intended to impose strict liability in the case of the prior indictment, and we would argue that there are indications that it's not a strict liability with regards to the condition of being under indictment. 29-23 grants immunity, and it's strictly a person can forfeit their firearms within 10 days of receiving service of their indictment. That to me says that the General Assembly didn't intend to impose strict liability. The state maintains with regards to the conviction, it's a strict liability. And if I may, I see I've run out of time. If I may make one final point.
Briefly.
Again, if we play out Mr. Martin's argument that he has to be recklessly aware that his offense is one that is a drug of abuse offense, definition of reckless is a person is reckless with respect to the circumstances when, with heedless indifference, he perversely disregards a known risk that such circumstances exist. If I'm a person, I'm in court, you know, I'm either plea or convict or, you know, found guilty of possession of marijuana, I'm sentenced in court, and I say, that's me. We don't have to look, I mean, drug abuse is statutorily defined, but I was convicted of possession of marijuana. The statute says I cannot have been convicted of an offense involving use of a drug of abuse. Marijuana, drug of abuse. The state submits that this reckless argument, especially in cases
Mr. Vann, what's the problem then? Why would the state simply not bring a certified copy of that prior conviction to court, shows that the defendant had been present, and offer that into evidence, establishing thereby the, you know, at least enough evidence from which the trier of fact can find beyond a reasonable doubt the necessary mens rea element?
That is always an option, Your Honor. We can always introduce a copy of the journal entry showing that that particular defendant has been convicted of a certain offense. But
that's what's done with prior convictions all the time.
That's correct. But especially in this case, and in many cases, defendants will stipulate to those prior convictions.
Counsel, that's not the problem, according to the appellee's argument here, is whether or not he was convicted. Was he aware that that conviction placed him in the category that precluded him from having a weapon? There's no doubt that he was convicted of something, mm-hmm. but in his own mind, what was he aware of with regards to the nexus between that conviction and did that classify to preclude him from a firearm? So defendant wasn't arguing that he wasn't convicted of something. He's just saying, in my mind, I didn't know what the consequences were with regards to the relationship to a firearm. So a certified copy or, you know, that's not really what's at issue here, is it?
Again, if I may have leave to answer the question. What's at issue, whether, you know, how far does reckless apply? Does he have to know of the consequences, or does he just have to know that his conviction was one of a drug of abuse? And again, if he stipulates to possession of marijuana, whether that fits the definition of drug of abuse, that's a matter of law. If we go as far as saying, I didn't know that that conviction disabled me from carrying that firearm, that becomes a mistake of law defense. We don't allow defense to raise those types of defenses. We don't allow defense to say, for example, I didn't know this pen could be a deadly weapon. And so the state would argue. And if there are no further questions.
Thanks, Mr. Vann.
Thank you.